Welcome to World Cafe Words and Music from WXPN. I'm David Dye. Jorma Kaukonen is best known for his work as guitarist with the seminal San Francisco band Jefferson Airplane, as well as for his ongoing work with bassist Jack Cassidy in Hot Tuna. That is, of course, unless you are one of the many guitarists who have attended his Fur Peace Ranch guitar camp. Jorma has a new solo album called River of Time and joins us in the studio. I ask him about the selection of tunes on the new album.
You know, I read a review somewhere. It was actually a good review, and I'm not complaining about this because we love good reviews, but one of the guy's comments, I think he sort of looked askance at the fact that he had felt that I had reinvented myself as an adult. And my comment to this is, 68 years old, if you can't be an adult, when's it going to happen, you know? So the selection of tunes is pretty much where I am today. I actually got off my lazy behind and wrote some new songs for this, which was exciting for me to find out that I could do that when I had to. And you know, my old favorites, you know, I love Reverend Gary Davis, and so we did a Reverend song, and we just discovered some other songs over the years, like Merle and Mississippi John Hurt and all these guys that have been writing great songs over the years.
Absolutely, including a great song that we know from you from the past. Been so long.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my recollection is that that song has never been done in the studio. Now, I have a friend that claims to know more about me than I do myself, and he might, so I'm not arguing with him. He claims there is a rare single version of that cut in the studio. I don't remember it, but ours is the one that Jack and I did was live.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, could you maybe recreate the magic here?
Well, we can play the song. I hope. Been so long since I belonged here, ever since I lost my way. That was when I still had something special left for me to say. Well, unto you, just to see your smile, laugh and look at me when you held me tight in the morning, child, now. Well, it's been so long since I felt at home in the mirror. Was a time I once came running down the street we used to live. That was when I still had something special left for me to give. Well, unto you, just to see your smile, laugh and look at me when you held me tight in the morning, child. Well, it's been so long since I felt at home in the mirror. Thank you.
Well, I'd say we got pretty close to the magic there. That's been
gosh,
so long.
I hope so.
With Jorma Kaukonen and Barry Mitterhoff. Should I call that a bouzouki or a large mandolin?
Great question. If you look inside the hole, it says bouzouki, but I call it an octave mandolin. Same deal.
I'm kind of glad you began with that tune because listening to this album, and I hear this on a lot of songs on here, and really you hear it throughout what you've done a lot throughout your career, Jorma, is there's a lot of lines moving against each other. And when you and Jack would play together, that's a lot about what that's about. Not so much like a rhythm player. When did you start thinking in those terms, or has that always been there?
I'm not sure that I ever intellectualized it in that way, but excuse me, but coming into when Jack and I started to get serious about playing electric bass and acoustic guitar together, what I was bringing to the table really pretty much was a finger-picking thing, which didn't have a lot of that. I mean, there certainly is a rhythmic component to it, but built into it was a vehicle for Jack to do what Jack does so well, which is to create these really nice melodic lines. And I sort of wound up hooking my chords together with little doodads here and there. I mean, to me, it seems perfectly logical from a finger-picking point of view. It's kind of hard to put into words, but
yeah,
I'd like to think that if you see me do it, it makes sense.
Absolutely. Okay, now here's the other thing. I was reading that when you first started playing in D.C., and this is totally logical because it's a hotbed of bluegrass music, and you were a flat picker to begin with.
I did, and I have to, you know, I must say that my flat picking is atrophied at about the age 16. But yeah, I started out playing old-timey music and stuff like that, and, if I have an hour to warm up, I can still do the Carter scratch, you know.
Right, right. And the transition to finger picking came at Antioch?
Right. It did come at Antioch. I mean, I'd always admired the finger pickers. I mean, it's such a great time for guitarists today because, you know, people just have so many resources for learning how to do stuff. But in those days, you kind of had to be near somebody that did it, and I wasn't. So I think the first, I'd listen to a lot of these finger pickers. Big Bill Brunzi, wowed me. I hadn't the slightest idea what he was doing. I heard the Joan Baez album, the first album, of course. I mean, that's not exactly finger picking, but I did it with my fingers. And then when I moved to Antioch, I met Ian Buchanan, and I think he was appalled by my playing, and he took me under his wing and showed me how to do it.
And you were always a three-finger picker?
I started out, I always have been. Ian played with three fingers. The Reverend, of course, only played with two. And, you know, of course, I wanted to emulate Ian in every possible way, so I started out playing with three. I couldn't imagine doing it in any other way, but there's lots of different ways to do it.
Right. Well, okay, we talked about a Gary Davis tune on here,
right,
but there's a Mississippi John Hurt tune on here.
Right.
And, of course, when I was in college, that's all anybody wanted to do was be able to play guitar like that.
Right. Well, you know, the funny thing is, when I started playing, the guitar was not the cool instrument that we know it today. The cool instruments when I was in high school, I started playing, were accordion, saxophone, and drums. Those were the cool instruments, and you were sort of a dweeb if you played the guitar, you know. Of course, now it has iconic status, but yeah, I mean, the idea to be able to just pick up your guitar, whichever guy you're studying, and just to be able to take it by yourself and play it is a dandy thought.
Absolutely. How'd you choose this particular Mississippi John Hurt tune?
Well, Barry and I got involved in a little project at Merkin Hall some years ago. It was a John Hurt tribute thing, and so we had to learn some John Hurt songs. And I had never really studied John when I was when I was a kid. I didn't. So I'd heard people play it, and I always thought, that'll be easy. I can do that. And of course, I got into it, and I realized I don't have the lifetime necessary to really learn it to play the way John did. But his songs were so great, and it just was really just an easy thing to kind of fall into. So the song that Barry and I kept out of that session that we continue to play is this Preaching on the Old Campground. And of course, Barry is going to be playing, if I'm not mistaken, an extremely fine vintage.
Of course.
And of course, there was a time when the tenor banjo was one of the cool instruments to play. It still is.
1924.
1924, yeah.
Well, that was it was in a lot of bands because it was loud.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
This one is loud, too, but it's not going to be that loud today.
It right. isn't?
Well, this is the mellow wind.
There's preaching tonight, preaching tonight, preaching on that old campground. Preaching tonight, there's preaching on that old campground. They're singing tonight, singing on that old campground. They're singing tonight, they're singing on that old campground. There's preaching tonight, preaching on that old campground. Preaching tonight. Preaching tonight, there's preaching on that old campground. There's singing tonight, singing on that old campground. Singing tonight, they're singing on that old campground. There's preaching tonight, on that old campground. Preaching tonight, there's preaching on that old campground. There's praying tonight, praying on that old campground. Praying tonight, there's praying on that old campground. There's preaching tonight, preaching on that old campground. Preaching tonight, there's preaching on that old campground. There's preaching tonight, on that old campground. Preaching tonight, there's preaching on that old campground.
Preaching on that old campground, as we mentioned, the Mississippi John Hurt tune that Yorma is doing, and Barry Mitterhoff here as well, from the new album River of Time. I, of course, came into your playing where a lot of everybody else did with those first Airplane albums.
Right.
And I was a folky, and I think that's maybe one reason why the Airplane appealed to me and, you know, the whole San Francisco thing. Would it be right to view the Airplane as a bunch of folkies who formed a rock band?
Absolutely. I mean, the first Airplane album takes off is a genuine folk rock album, in my opinion. And, you know, we sort of started to mutate later on, but it's absolutely a folk rock band. I mean, with the exception of Jack when he got into the band, who'd played rhythm and blues and a lot of other different stuff, and Spencer, the drummer on the second album, who'd played a lot of different stuff too, we really were just a bunch of hootenanny and...
did you... resist electric guitar?
Well, in the beginning, it's kind of funny. In the beginning, I did because it just seemed, it smacked of, it was unauthentic. Yeah. And I was, you know, we were striving for authenticity in those days. But it's very seductive, obviously. And, you know, I got sucked into it. Some years later, down at our place at the Fur Peach Ranch, John Hartford did a show not too long before he passed away. We were talking about this. I was telling him how I admired his commitment to traditional music because he certainly could have gone another direction also. Old-timey music, I said. And he went, well, Yorma, that stuff you guys did in the 60s, that's old-timey music. And I thought, yeah, you're right, it is.
Now, was there any particular technology in the electric guitar that you particularly fell in love with?
Well, I think what happened, I mean, we sort of discovered all that, you know, sustaining and feedbacking stuff a little bit later on. Mike Bloomfield opened the door to me for that. But when I went to audition for the band, I mean, this is really 60s stuff. I went to audition for this band. I was, oh, you know, I'm not interested in that kind of stuff. And at the time, I had a beautiful L5 Gibson guitar, blonde, all maple. That's another story. I don't have that anymore either. Yeah. But anyway, and I went there, and Ken Kesey, of all people, was there. And he had, for some reason, I can't imagine, he had an Echoplex. We remember those sort of tape things. And he said, you ought to plug your guitar into this. And I plugged it in, and it went wah, 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 wah. And I played a tune with myself and stuff. And I went, oh, this is kind of fun. So it sort of chummed me in.
And before the whole sustain and all that. And everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we, like I said, in the first album, we're just playing, the electric guitars are amplified guitars. We're not really doing stuff that electric guitars allow you to do.
Right. And I heard that Embryonic Journey was just, you thought it was too folky for
that. Right, that was on our set. Oh, I was absolutely, it was so wrong. How wrong I was.
Yeah, there you go with that. I was also reading when you first got out there to California, Santa Clara, you were, part of the way you were making a living was teaching. And it's interesting that that is certainly a thread that continues today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, my buddy Barry teaches too. I mean, first of all, teaching, it's a nice way to make some money. It's fun. And it has certainly, back then and today, has improved my playing, you know, because if you want to teach somebody something, you kind of have to know what you're doing. I mean, when I learned to play, the guys that taught me didn't care about that. They just said, here's how it goes, play it, and I'd play it. And I said, well, how's that? And they go, well, that sucks. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll try it again. But I actually learned what I was doing at an early age, and it opened a lot of doors for me, and even more today.
Well, of course, the reason why we're talking about this is because of Fur Peace Ranch, where people can go and hang out with Barry, hang out with you, yeah. A lot of other players. And I understand that it's not just really accomplished players that end up going there.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you know, my thing with teaching has always been to make it unintimidating. I mean, you know, there are some things we know that are very difficult to play, and I probably won't do that. I think about myself as a intermediate level guitar player with a lot of experience, but, you know, you can explain something to anybody, and if they fritter away enough time at it, they will learn how to do it.
I got to ask you about Ohio. How did Fur Peace end up in Ohio? And
you know, it's just one of these God shot kind of things. I just, in 89, we were just finishing up the airplane tour, and this guy that I knew from South Florida, he passed away last year, he just called me up out of the blue and said, hey, how are you doing? I went, well, how are you doing? And he said, well, I own this farm in Southeast Ohio, and I'm going to sell it. Land was very cheap back then, very cheap. And my wife, Vanessa, said, don't do it. You're insane. And I said, I got a good feeling about this. So I flew to Ohio and I went down. It was a cold winter that year. And I looked at this piece of property. There was nothing there except this really decrepit A-frame, really decrepit, and a lot of multifloral rose and poison ivy and some very pretty hills and some other stuff. And I just had a good feeling about it. So we bought it. And then I was living in Woodstock at the time. Then we moved down there. And since there was nothing there but pretty things to look at and poison ivy, we bought another little farm where we're still living today, and just one thing kind of led to another. Now, when we first bought this place, we thought, because you talked about the teaching business, I thought, wow, you know, we can have a guitar camp. I had visions of us sitting around in bales of hay around a campfire, you know, singing Kumbaya or something. Well, maybe not, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But my wife, who had a real existence as a civil engineer before she met me, her vision was a little more profound than this. And so in 96, 97, she said, we got to do this. So she kicked me in the butt a couple times and did all the stuff I couldn't have done. And she built we built the ranch, and we're into our 12th year now.
That's fantastic. And a lot of, it wasn't just, I mean, it's a lot of buildings. It's a pretty fair.
We have... Yeah, we have, I think, 27 buildings here now. We have our own little NPR show, WOUB, out of Ohio, and we have a 200-seat theater. You should come down and visit us sometime.
I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that. If I've been to Levon's space, I should come to yours.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know somebody that can make that happen for you.
Excellent. Jorma Kalkinen is our guest, and we got time for one more.
Okay. Well, I would like to do this little instrumental thing that I... wrote for my three-year-old daughter. I should say our three-year-old daughter. And her name is Israel Love. It's called Izzy's Lullaby. Unfortunately, it doesn't make her go to sleep. She likes it, and she says, Dad, play it again. But anyway, it's called Izzy's Lullaby. And...
Izzy's Lullaby from Jorma Kalkinen. I'm David Dye. World Cafe Words and Music from WXPN is produced at WXPN in Philadelphia and XPN.org. There are more World Cafe sessions for you to listen to at our website. Also, you can sign up for our daily newsletter about the show. That's all at worldcafe.npr.org. As always, thanks for spending your time with the World Cafe.